The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Hello, Olympia! Are you tired of getting your news and information from boring, monotone drones? Would you prefer a little spice with your public affairs? Would you like to know what the Olympia activist community is up to? Well, now is your opportunity, because the Thunderbolt has come to chaos. Yes, kids, the Thunderbolt is your guide to all of the news that's fit to suppress. The Thunderbolt strikes every Saturday at 1 a.m. right here on KAOS 89.3 FM Olympia. All right. Hey, people. Welcome to the Thunderbolt for June 4th, 2021. We start off this week's show with an old adage stating that crime doesn't pay. As with many old adages, though, the actual fact of the matter is that crime not only does pay, but it pays better than anything else that you can do. However, that is beside the point that I wish to make here. Another more modern adage states that no good deed ever goes unpunished. That axiom does indeed seem to be more or less true. However accurate or not these old sayings may be, though, it would seem that both of these sayings do occasionally apply to car thieves. Jamari J. Reed and a friend of his were out cruising in a brand new Toyota RAV4 that they had just stolen when they spotted another young man named Tykel Wilson struggling with a flat tire on a Mitsubishi Lancer. Mr. Reed decided to do his civic duty and he pulled over to assist a brother in need. Whereupon, Mr. Wilson promptly attempted to steal the stolen RAV4 from Mr. Reed, leaving behind the Lancer with the flat tire, which was, of course, also stolen. Mr. Wilson promptly wrecked the RAV4, attempting to get away from the scene, though, whereupon Mr. Reed pulled out a gun. He began threatening Mr. Wilson for daring to steal his stolen RAV4. Then the police showed up before things could escalate further. And I'm thinking that those police ended up having a lot of fun unraveling that one. Steals a frigging Lancer anyway. So, there are a few news items I would like to mention and commentate upon. First of all, Everyone these days seems to be portraying China as some kind of evil genius that is fixing to take over the world. On the one hand, that very well may be true. On the other hand, though, this is the country that banned Winnie the Pooh from the Chinese internet because there was a Twitter meme wherein a lot of people started comparing the appearance of the Pooh to that of Chinese President Xi Jinping. And China is the country that just banned the Oscars from the Chinese media because they didn't like it that the winning director award went to a Chinese expatriate named Chloe Zhao, who had been critical of the Chinese regime in the past. I'm sorry, but the Chinese seem to be rather stupid for being such alleged geniuses. And meanwhile, I just learned that in just the first year of his administration, Donald Trump droned more people in Yemen and Pakistan than Barack Obama did in the entirety of his 8 years. And that is truly astonishing, as the Obama was certainly no slacker in that department. Obama, in fact, had already increased the use of drone attacks by a factor of 10 over that of the previous administration of George W. Bush. Yet while both Bush's and Obama's dronings got a lot of press and a lot of protests, the Rumpf's achievements and remote-controlled mass murder were almost completely ignored. While I knew that the Rump was continuing with the drone wars, even I had absolutely no idea they had elevated the attacks to that extent. And be clear here, the victims of these drone attacks have been mostly civilians, not soldiers. Obama's strikes killed thousands of innocents, and it has been reported that over 250 children alone have died in Donald Trump's gravity won't pull you through drone attacks. Gravity won't pull you through. While drones can indeed take out military targets, they are more commonly used for purposes of political assassination. And meanwhile, events here at home are demonstrating that actually seeing something with your own eyes presents a radically different point of view than merely having something explained to you using words. And this tends to be especially the case in scenarios wherein the explainer is lying to you through their teeth. Yes, people, this thing of police doing really nasty things to people in the dark is absolutely nothing new. The only differences now are due strictly to the advent of cell phone cameras. People can now see the inhumane brutality with their own eyes. And even more importantly, the videos are also now exposing the fact that the police constantly lie through their teeth. Yes, people, this thing with authority figures violently abusing their authority has literally been going on for countless centuries. It's just that these days, everyone can see it with their own eyes, and they don't like it. So it would seem that these days, we need to update yet another old adage. Now we need to say that a picture is worth a thousand years. And meanwhile, an anti-Marxist speaker named Jordan Peterson recently stated that no Marxist would ever dare to debate him. So students at Boise State University had invited Mr. Peterson to speak at a forum that was centered upon his writings. And after Mr. Peterson's boast, the students decided to inquire whether or not the noted Marxist economist, Richard Wolff, might be interested in debating Mr. Peterson, which challenge, contrary to Mr. Peterson's prediction, Mr. Wolff gladly accepted. However, Mr. Peterson ended up backing out of that engagement and declined to debate Mr. Wolff. The hypocrisy of his action so annoyed the students at Boise State that they invited Mr. Wolff to speak at their forum anyway, which he subsequently did. In another piece of news, a movie called Nomad won the Academy Award for Best Picture of the Year. Well, I haven't watched it yet, but evidently, it's a movie about people who are living in vans and RVs. Since I myself spent over 34 years living in various vehicles, including 28 years in the same converted school bus, and since I am in fact currently in the market for another school bus right now, in fact, I find it truly ironic that my chosen lifestyle that I've always thought to be so different and so unique has now become a major mainstream cultural meme. I'm not sure what I think about that, which is probably why I haven't watched the movie yet. And in yet other news, large numbers of mothers are now sending their children to the U.S. border unaccompanied, because they know that the Americans are now accepting unaccompanied children. So do you think these are bad mothers who are abandoning their children? Or do you think that these are mothers at the furthest extremes of desperation, throwing the equivalent of a Hail Mary pass? If these mothers simply wanted to abandon their children, then I'm sure that wouldn't be all that hard to arrange, especially in a country like Mexico. But instead, these mothers are traveling long distances under very hazardous conditions, and then they often pay lots of money to often ruthless and dishonest people in order to get their children into the United States. So how desperate do you have to be in order to do something like that? C Since World War II, the United States has lost every single war that it has ever fought. And this is in spite of the fact that since World War II, the United States military has won nearly every individual battle that it has ever fought. This seeming paradox is one of the results of the United States' war for profit model of economic development. When you are fighting wars for profit, the goal is not to win the wars. The goal is to drag the wars out for as long as possible. Even disregarding the lengthy list of countries that the United States destroyed between World War II and the 9/11 attacks, the list of countries directly destroyed by the United States just since 2001 includes Iraq, Libya, and Syria. All countries that have formerly been economically and socially thriving, even if highly regressive politically. Libyans and Iraqis enjoyed the highest standards of living in their respective regions. But that is a direct violation of International Monetary Fund austerity protocols. Plus, Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein had both been attempting to commit the original sin of using their oil money to start investment banks that were meant to directly compete with the IMF and the World Bank. After the removals of Gaddafi and Hussein, that left Bashar al-Assad as the last country standing in the near Middle East that refused to worship the golden calf of Wall Street. That left Syria as the only ally that Russia and Iran still had in the region as well. Afghanistan, though, was different. Afghanistan was a basket case when the Americans arrived, and Afghanistan is several orders of magnitude worse off now than it was then. The stated goal at the time of the Afghan invasion was to remove the Taliban. After 20 years of a war, supposedly fought to remove the Taliban, after hundreds of thousands of lives lost, after millions of refugees displaced, after $2.25 trillion spent, the Taliban still controls large swaths of Afghanistan. And most observers think that the Taliban is going to resume overall power in Afghanistan as soon as the Americans are gone. Afghanistan is also different in that it is a very rural country. Iraq is largely a flat country, and over half the population of Iraq lives in Baghdad. Afghanistan, on the other hand, is covered with some of the highest mountains in the world, and the five largest Afghan cities combined house less than 10% of the population. Afghanistan has virtually no infrastructure. Afghanistan has been almost continuously at war for over 40 years. While Afghanistan was briefly displaced by Syria for having the largest numbers of citizens living in foreign refugee camps, the Afghanis have now once again regained their decade-long lead in that area. According to the Costs of War Project, since the American occupation in 2001, an estimated 241,000 people have died as a direct result of this intervention. And the United States has spent nearly $2.26 trillion on military operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Cost of War Project noted that, quote, these figures do not include deaths caused by disease, loss of access to food, water, infrastructure, and or other indirect consequences of the war. And even as the United States taxpayer shells out $2.26 trillion for military operations in Afghanistan, 70% of the Afghani people are living on less than $1 per day. And so, in light of the seeming utter failure of stated American policy, what was it all for? Afghanistan has no oil, little strategic value other than the fact that it borders Iran, and other than some mineral wealth, there doesn't seem to be much in particular that Wall Street would covet. Yes, the Taliban were not allowing the West to build oil pipelines across their territory, and many think that this was the real reason for the Afghan invasion and occupation. While I suspect that did indeed play a part, I have another theory about the real reason for the Afghan invasion and occupation. For you see, here's the thing about Afghanistan. Before the American invasion and occupation, the Taliban had completely eliminated the Afghan opium trade. But then, the United States invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001, and by October of 2002, Afghanistan went from supplying 0% of the world's heroin supply to supplying 90% of the world's heroin supply. Mission accomplished. Yes, people, the CIA has been spending the last 20 years building a narco state empire in Afghanistan. This empire is financed largely by their drug trafficking operations, and it is underpinned by a private army of contracted Afghan mercenaries who operate completely independently of the Afghan military. They report instead to the Afghan Intelligence Service, of course, which service is itself, of course, wholly owned by the CIA. Therefore, the departure of the American troops from Afghanistan means little to the CIA, and in fact, American troops would often put a kink into the CIA's flow. And even as all of this unimaginable fire, death, and destruction continued raining down upon Afghanistan for over 20 years,
CIA officers could often be found in the tropics managing their drug trade as they lied in hammocks sipping their cocktails.
And to make the irony complete, the CIA-sponsored Afghani drug lords are mostly using the Russian mob to handle the actual distribution of most of the Afghani heroin these days. So don't worry, the CIA, at least, will still be buried neck deep in the Afghani quagmire, probably for the foreseeable future. Violent chaos is their breeding ground, after all. How happy for Afghanistan. And we're going to take a quick station break now. The Thunderbolt will be back in just a moment. The views expressed on this program are strictly those of the show's producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station nor anyone associated with this radio station. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. All right, welcome back. So last month, here at the Thunderbolt, we reported upon a social experiment that was conducted back in the 60s called Soul City, wherein a prominent civil rights activist named Floyd McKissick got some federal money and founded what was envisioned to be a racially integrated town in North Carolina in order to provide a model for how such a thing could be done. I pointed out how back in the day, Mr. McKissick worked with Martin Luther King Jr. And that back in the day, Mr. McKissick was himself nearly as prominent as Dr. King was. However, Floyd McKissick is pretty much unknown these days, whilst Martin Luther King now has his own national holiday. I would suggest that this was because Floyd McKissick chose to invest his political capital into what became a failed experiment, albeit that this failure was mostly due to factors beyond Mr. McKissick's control, whilst Dr. King chose to become a martyr. And yes, I just said that Dr. King chose to become a martyr because it is very obvious to me from several things he said that Martin Luther King not only knew damn well that someone was going to kill him, especially after he spoke out against the war in Vietnam and tied the war machine to the racism machine, But he also understood that his own death would be the best thing that could happen for his movement and for his legacy. And so that brings us to one of the ironies of Dr. King's legacy. Of all the things that Martin Luther King Jr. is justifiably honored for, I think the one thing he should be most honored for is the one thing I've never heard anyone even seriously discuss. I.e. my contention that the man very consciously and very literally gave his life for his cause. That is pretty much the last full measure. And that is how someone truly lives on in history. However, everything is always intimately intertwined with everything else, especially in the worlds of politics, finance, and war and peace, and humanity as a whole has still failed to decipher Dr. King's message. For instance, the World Economic Forum calls itself the International Organization for Public-Private Cooperation. Such is the vision articulated by Klaus Schwab, founder and executive chairman of the WEF, which held its 2021 summit on the theme of the Great Reset. As Global Research points out, the use of the definite article "the" in that statement is quite significant. Even though the World Economic Forum claims by way of disclaimer to be, quote, independent, impartial, and not tied to any special interests, the fact is the WEF organization has become the central mouthpiece for global financial and corporate elites in the world today. They call me Blue Suede Shubert, the king of the Council on Foreign Relations determines policy. And then the WEF relays that policy. And in that role, the WEF is kind of like a spider sitting in the middle of a tightly knit web.
A privately funded mega nonprofits, think tanks, and assorted lobbying organizations through which the 0.1% seek to shape policies and events to their advantage. An activity at which they have proven to be quite effective.
However, do not mistake the WEF for just any industry lobbying group. Because since Davos, the WEF has transformed into a sort of de facto world government that, in elite circles anyway, eclipses even the United Nations in its influence. And in this context, Schwab's book outlining his vision of this Great Reset has been touted as, quote, the first policy book on the COVID crisis globally, unquote. But Schwab's book is not just about COVID. According to reports, I haven't read it myself. But Schwab evidently comprehensively deals with just about every aspect of governments and the economy, and it basically attempts to sell the same snake oil that Schwab and his ilk have been pushing for decades. Their formula is untold riches for them and austerity for everyone else. And of special interest among these is a 600-page report released as part of the WEF's Global Redesign Initiative, which was organized along with the United Nations in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis and described as, quote, the most comprehensive proposal for redesigning global governance since the formulation of the United Nations, unquote. Yes, people, all of the WEF's proposals have more or less the same official line: a radical transformation of global systems in line with new technological, political, and environmental realities. And ironically, I agree 100% with the WEF on those points. I just agree 100% in the opposite direction. These people always fail to mention the fact that they are themselves responsible for most of those technological, political, and environmental realities. The transformations humanity has endured lately were conceived of and promoted by the same elitist technocrats who brought us all of these technological, political, environmental realities in the first place, such as Mr. Schwab himself. And all of this is being fully backed by all of the usual suspects amongst the usual global financial powers, whose interests, of course, the rest of us exist merely to serve. What they mean when they refer to a public-private partnership is a partnership that completely ignores democratic norms and bypasses all legislative or parliamentary or any other type of public input or control. What they mean when they refer to a public-private partnership is that all such decisions are to be executed by the private part of that partnership, and that those decisions will come from the top down. What they mean when they refer to a public-private partnership is an authoritarian plutocracy where any and all ability to resist their top-down agendas is completely eliminated. And now, it's time to get to work. All right, and I'm going to fill out the rest of the hour with some music. This is a band from Ireland, as you'll probably be able to tell, called The Sid. Enjoy.
I'm just a CD Island.
We'll be right back. Wow. Heavy metal Celtic. That was the Sid, S-I-D-H. That last tune was called Nitro. The one before that was called Iridium. Before that, we had I'm Just a Sid in Ireland. And we started off with Glitch. And that's it for this week. Hope to see you next week. And in the meanwhile, please keep in mind that the views expressed on the Thunderbolt are those of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station or anyone associated with this radio station. The Thunderbolt website is dana98501.wordpress.com. 98501 is the downtown Olympia zip code, if that helps you remember that. And you can contribute to the Thunderbolt cause at patreon.com/thethunderbolt. Glad you joined us this week. We hope to see you next week. And in the meanwhile...
Thank you very much.